NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccaro at the White House. Hurricane Sandy is barreling up the East Coast. Forecasters say it will come ashore late Monday over New Jersey. Weather Channel meteorologist Julie Martin is in Nags Head, North Carolina, where they're feeling the effects of Sandy.
This hurricane feels more like a nor'easter to me here along the Outer Banks. In fact, the winds are coming from the northeast. They're tropical storm force, believe it or not. And we've been seeing them and feeling them since about midnight.
NBC meteorologist Al Roker says some communities could see up to 12 inches of rain over the next 72 hours.
Coastal flood warnings in effect with coastal flood watches. And the winds are going to be a big problem as well. We now have high wind warnings in effect, winds gusting up to 75 to 80 miles per hour through the mid-Atlantic and the northeast.
Forecasters add the scope of the coming East Coast superstorm makes it pretty much irrelevant where it hits land, because the effects will be felt in a third of the country. This is NBC News Radio. The White House says President Obama is canceling campaign appearances in Virginia and Colorado in the coming days so he can monitor the expected superstorm. Mitt Romney also canceled a stop in Virginia due to Sandy. Hawaii residents appear to have been spared the threat of a tsunami strike after a powerful earthquake off western Canada overnight. Honolulu Mayor Peter Carlisle said residents had to evacuate quickly, just in case.
When it happened in Japan, we had about 6 hours. When it happens off the coast of South America, we have that much time, maybe a little more. But this was only about 2.5 hours. So, because it's a direct shot right at the Hawaiian island.
The statewide tsunami warning has been downgraded to a tsunami advisory. There were no major reports of damage reported anywhere as a result of the 7.7 magnitude quake. Madonna drew boos and triggered a walkout by several concertgoers. The Material Girl touted voting for President Obama while performing in New Orleans. I'm Mike Vaccaro, NBC News Radio.
Come into the Home Depot and discover the new exclusive line of Husky hand tools. They're improved, affordable, and guaranteed forever. Start with a three-piece plier and wrench set for the new lower price of just $9.88. Add a few new tools to your workbench. Even though your workbench may wear out long before these new improved Husky hand tools do. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. U.S. only. See store for details.
GEICO says, let's make life simpler.
It's a fact of modern life. Switching isn't easy. Your bank, your cable company, your girlfriend. Let's just say each switch comes with a certain degree of difficulty. Switching to GEICO, now that couldn't be easier. First of all, it only takes 15 minutes. And just like that, you could be saving hundreds on car insurance. No muss, no fuss, no irate, vengeful, significant others.
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
You wouldn't drive your kids in the car without them wearing seatbelts, would you? So why leave them unprotected when you're gone? Learn about the latest techniques for maximizing your wealth and protecting your assets for your heirs. Join me, Wayne Zell, for Blueprint for Wealth every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. I'm an estate planning attorney with Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman. Each week, we talk about how you can realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. That's Blueprint for Wealth, Saturdays at 10 a.m., right here on 1500 AM.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, DC's one and only food and wine variety show.
Next Sunday, October 28th, we'll be shaking it up in the studio with Mike Isabella's Bandolero. And cookbook author Kim O'Donnell's going to be in. She's talking about her latest book. And have you heard Taco Bamba? Well, you'll hear all about it from Victor Albizu.
I'm shaking it up right now. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday, live at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because a Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Merdat Negaban, who's the founder and CTO of Beam Smart, Inc., Steve Seiden, the owner and president of Acquired Data Solutions, Sandeep Sangavi, co-founder and CEO of Data RPM Corporation, and Julia Stevens, the executive director of Crisis Link. Joining us first is a young man by the name of Merdat Negaban. Did I get that right?
Yes, perfect.
The founder and CTO of Beam Smart, Inc. What is Beam Smart?
Well, Beam Smart is built on the belief that smartphones and tablets, they are going to become remote control of everybody's life. So what we did, or what we are doing, is that we are connecting the smartphone with all these sensors like GPS and camera that's integrated in it to cloud. And, you know, at least in our definition, cloud is the will become the infinite source of information and knowledge. And I use specifically the word knowledge because I think what's going to happen is that people using these smart devices, getting connected to the cloud, will eventually become more knowledgeable. I mean, the knowledge in our brain is limited. So now we have this infinite source of information and knowledge sitting on the cloud. So our job is to tie people through these devices to cloud and make them smarter and make them safer.
Right. When was the company founded?
Basically in 2011.
And how big are you as of today?
We have about 30 people, which includes developers and sales and marketing people.
When did the idea occur to you that, wow, I better do this?
Well, actually, the idea was in like year 2000. You know, goes back there, but we were waiting for broadband wireless to come along. And those days, you know, we had WiMAX, and WiMAX was becoming very popular. But unfortunately, WiMAX never took off. And we ran into, you know, in conjunction with 2008 recession, we ran into a huge problem. So finally, 3G becoming 4G is now here, right. And Wi-Fi access points are widely available. So that's
is this your first startup?
No, this is my second, actually.
Why startups? Why do you do this?
Well, startups, I mean, you know, again, it's more or less it's a personal thing. It's like that power within you that makes you to go and change things, you know, overcome all the obstacles in front of you, fight and build something that no one else has built.
So when did you realize that you had that, you call it power in you? Where did that first start showing up in you?
Actually, you know, I always try to be developer and creator and become, you know, be an innovator, whether I am that person or not. That, you know,
all the way back into your childhood?
All the way back to the childhood. But
so give us an example of that in your childhood. When were you doing something like this?
In the childhood, you know, solving some mathematical problems that not many people were able to solve. You know, start looking at, looking back, those are the kind of things that I used to do. But one thing that really influenced my life was I started coaching soccer at youth level. And that, believe it or not, actually there was even a study that it makes you more, working with kids make you smarter. And that gave me the discipline, the concept of how to build teams and use this concept of teamwork, especially with, you know, the beautiful game, which is soccer, that gave me the know-how, sort of that virtual MBA that I needed to become an entrepreneur.
So it's not just about the idea, it's about how you channel people?
I think, at least from my point of view, at the early stage of building a company, the biggest thing is how to build a team.
Right.
Once you build the team, then you can build grow the company, bring customers, bring people who get interested in what you are doing and support you to grow the company. And
so that's fascinating to me. How did you learn how to build a team? I mean, that's a difference than coaching soccer and learning how to build a team.
Actually, it's very similar because, you know, there are two styles of coaching, and that same style comes to, you know, building and developing a company. One style is that you have a box and you hire people to put them in the box. That is good for established companies. I mean, that's at least my view. And then there is this other thing that they give you these resources and you have an idea, you have a vision, and then how to manage to get the best out of the resources, the people that you have to achieve your goals and objectives. And that's exactly what happens in a youth soccer type thing.
Your 30 people don't all live in Washington, as I recall.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's one of the beauty of what we do.
Well, beauty and hard part. How do you manage these people and build a team of people who are global, as I recall?
You know, a few years ago, it was hard. Actually, today, this flexible type of working environment and being able to connect and, you know, create a real-time collaboration, which is what we have done, in some ways, it has actually some advantages. And these advantages are things that we are fully, taking advantage of it, I guess. And what it is that we have people in Europe, we have people in Canada, we have people in United States. And my day starts at 6 a.m. in the morning, and I start talking to people from China. I come all the way to Europe, and we organize and manage things till 11 o'clock our time, Eastern United States time. And after that, I get ready for business-type activity within U.S.
And somehow you're able to maintain some semblance of a team with these people all over the world?
We have a very simple formula for that, and that's task, ownership, and milestone. And once we have that, it's amazing that once the tasks are defined in a simple manner. And by the way, remember that startup companies, especially high-tech companies that you claim you want to go and challenge the big guys, you have to have passion in it. And once everybody's passionate about it and involved and they have stocks and share within the company, or they feel that they are the owner of the company, the management becomes much easier.
But you've got to select the right people. And how did you learn to do that?
That's a very interesting question. What was the process? The end result was that I came to this conclusion that I have three criteria as picking people. Number one, they have to be passionate about what we do. Number two, we got to trust them. Trust meaning that they are capable of delivering things. And number three for me was knowledge. Actually, knowledge is number three. So passionate people, I think they have more desire, more drive to get something done than knowledgeable people. So passion, trust, and knowledge. So these are the three main criteria for us to select and pick people.
Did you hire some of these people remotely, or did you meet all these individuals?
No, we met all these individuals. We put them together, and then we built teams around them.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually one of the ways that this flexible, multi kind of location, multi-global, multi-regional thing works.
Right. Where are you from?
From Iran.
From Iran. When did you come to the United States?
I was 16 years old. I came late 70s to this country.
That was an interesting time. What was that like for you to come here at that time of history?
Well, we were going through all these changes in Iran, and, that for a young person who is, has hard time to, sitting here right now, of course, has hard time to digest that. It was kind of difficult, but I think the United States was a very good place for me.
Yeah, but what goes on in the mind of a 16-year-old leaving a country that's the only thing you really knew and came here? What was the hardest thing about it?
The hardest thing was what's unexpected here. Once I got here, I got busy with my education and the challenges of maintaining, supporting myself, going through all these steps that I need to get myself educated. So the challenge of getting education and challenge of supporting to get that education done, I think those were interesting things.
What was life like growing up in Iran for you?
Life was, you know, interesting during, you know, I was growing up during Shah. And, you know, from one point, we were looking at a situation that was challenging from a political point of view, but at the same time, it was very modernized, at least at that point, or was trying to get itself modernized.
How do you suppose growing up there shaped the way you lead your company today?
One of the key things that you see, not in entire, you know, Iranian population, but in some select Iranian population, and we have a lot of good people, you know, Persians in the United States that are entrepreneurs, by the way, including founder of eBay and so on and so forth. You know, a lot of those characters actually was built during those era, that we were entrepreneur. We wanted it to be the best. We wanted it to fight and present ourselves to the world that we can really challenge and be able to compete at the highest level. So those things were, you know, was kind of integrated into our DNA.
Into yours in particular.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those days.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing that I accomplished, that's a very interesting question, was to get myself through a very challenging time, you know, actually finalizing and finishing my education. I think that was probably the toughest thing.
You've had an interesting career in the sense you worked in healthcare in the cochlear implant, which was early stage. And how did that lead you into where you are today?
Well, let me kind of, I worked in communication and, you know, environment. And cochlear, which I was really proud of what I did, was, you know, applying that knowledge, that know-how about communication into how you get the signals and be able to pass it to the brain. So that was one of the best things that I did, you know, along to other achievements that I had. And then, you know, that gave me the knowledge and the know-how and the structure or the foundation to be where I am.
What's the website address, Murdat, for BeamSmart?
www.beamsmart.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Murdat Negabon, who's the founder and CTO of a company called BeamSmart. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is your business spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz from Vistage. Joining us today is
Julia Stevens.
And Julia, what organization are you with?
Crisis Link.
What is Crisis Link?
Crisis Link is a crisis intervention and suicide prevention service. We provide our services primarily through a 24/7 hotline.
And I understand you have an event coming up you'd like to tell us about.
Yes, we're trying to make an impact and a real difference with our military and the suicide rate that has just become a terrible crisis. On November 14th from 8 to 9:30 a.m., we're having a breakfast and a fall educational forum called Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. And we're going to be discussing how we can help the growing crisis of suicide among our military personnel.
What do you like most about your job?
I get to meet and talk with so many people who, in fact, give so much back to their community and their neighbors. It's fabulous.
And for those that haven't heard about how serious this problem is for the military, just bring us up to speed.
Crisis Link takes telephone calls from people in crisis, many of whom are suicidal. For our military, the recent Time article showed that one per day have died by suicide this year, and 18 per day die of suicide of our veterans.
So this is a big problem.
It's a huge problem, and it's just growing.
Oh, my gosh. If someone wanted more information, how could they find out about you guys?
They can go to our website, www.crisislink, that's all one word, .org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Julia Stevens, who's the executive director of Crisis Link. This has been your Business Spotlight. Have a great day. Bye-bye. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Allaire, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Steve Seiden, who's the owner and president of a company called Acquired Data Solutions. What is Acquired Data Solutions, Steve?
Acquired Data Solutions is an engineering services company that specializes in test data management and data acquisition. And we basically turn data acquisition into action by getting the data from different sensors and different machines and making it actionable for the staff and the engineers.
And why is that, for the layperson, why is that such an important thing?
Because typically, most businesses are actually engineering companies, and they make products. And quality is very important to everybody who buys a product. And if it's not tested and people can't understand what's going on at the sensor level, at the measurement level, then sometimes you get faulty equipment.
So that's what you guys do, is to provide that kind of data.
Correct.
That becomes actionable and it results in a better product.
That's correct.
Great. When was the company founded?
1997.
And how big or small are you today?
We're about 20 people.
Why start the company?
Well, that's an interesting question. I always had a dream of owning my own business after graduate school, but I didn't know what the other side would ever look like. So what happened was, after I decided to leave graduate school, somebody invited me to join their company, and I decided to join as a contractor because he was a great salesman, but I didn't know what the business looked like. Well, when I got there, the business, I was the only engineer, and it was pretty much defunct, but he had about 15 contracts. And this guy left 3 weeks after I got there and told me either to buy the business or get a job, and I bought the business.
Never having run a business, knowing nothing about business, you decided to buy a business.
Well, since I was about 14, I always worked doing software with my dad. So my dad was an entrepreneur. I always coded, and that was my dream. I saw him always having time for me, and I always wanted to have a business. Not again, it's what the other side you don't know about, which is the hard part.
Right. You were coding software at 14?
Pretty much.
What was that like?
Just was, you know, my dad needed help, and I would write some code for him.
So he'd say, "Hey, Junior, why don't you help me write some code?"
To some degree. So it was funny because I actually went to computer camp in ninth grade back in 1981 in Wisconsin. So I actually went to University of Wisconsin Whitewater to go to computer camp in 1981. So that was pretty early. We had one of the first PCs. So I was always in it.
Yeah. So it must have been scary to buy a business the way it occurred for you.
I don't think scary was the right word.
How would you describe it?
I would say I didn't know any better. So if you don't know any better, you can't be scared. So it's only once you understand what the dark side looks like or the other side looks like that it becomes scary.
But you have to have confidence to jump in. And what gave you that confidence?
Well, I believe to be a great entrepreneur, you need three things. The first is you have to love to sell. The second is you have to be okay with conflict. And the third, you have to love yourself. Now, I was pretty good at the first two. The last one, that was the scary part.
So how did that interfere with running the business, loving yourself?
I had a lot of negative self-talk, thinking that I was one of the only people that had negative self-talk. So if I didn't close a deal in a certain amount of time, I didn't think I was good enough. But I've had a business for 15 years. I'm certainly good enough. But it wasn't. I had to learn how to accept myself. And I had to learn how to love myself. And I had to learn how to become self-compassionate to myself. And things are okay.
So for you, that was a big deal, wasn't it?
It's huge.
Tell us a little bit more about what you did to overcome that and what happened when you did.
Well, I started by finding people. I always believed experience is expensive, and how do I lessen my experience? And I have lessened my experience by surrounding myself with people that have similar issues. And I did that. I found out I wasn't alone. I found out that I was okay. I found out that I was good enough by reading, by learning how to meditate, by having self-compassion, by learning positive psychology and maximizing my strengths, learning what my priorities are, my family and my wife. And the business ran. There was a time where I had to step away from the business for a little while, and the business was fine.
Yeah. You said in the green room, you grew up around two entrepreneurial parents. and it was a great gift to you. Talk to us about that.
Well, I believe the greatest gift in the world is time. And anybody that gives you their time is gifting it to you.
And these guys were entrepreneurs, and they still managed to give you their time?
Well, yes. They showed up to every sporting event of mine. They were always there, and they created a life that allowed them to have the dollars they needed and be there for their kids.
Great.
Does your father still play a role in your business or your life?
So my father was a original investor, and the way the business started was it was my father, his business partner, and me. But I started the business. But they'd always been in data acquisition and instrumentation. So it was a natural bridge for them.
Mm-hmm.
But my father eventually, in when the economy went south in 2001, 2002, we had to do a lot of work on site. He was a 70-year-old man. He's not going to work on site. So the business outgrew what he could do. And unfortunately, we had to be still very active in my life. We see each other all the time. But the business outgrew him, and that was a very tough thing to do, was to tell your father you don't have any more work for him.
Wow. What was that like for you?
It was challenging because this is a man that's always been there for me,
yeah.
And the work went away. And what's interesting is I'm still in business with his business partner, but he was a passive investor. But his business partner was one of my greatest mentors. There was a time that I wanted to commit corporate suicide. And I called him and said, I want to quit. And he told me, you can quit, no problem. But only when you collapsed. Not when you thought you're going to collapse, but when you physically collapsed.
So you've done a tremendous amount of work on yourself. You recognized I need to be different, and you've accomplished that. What changed in the business over time as you worked on yourself?
I became more relaxed. I realized that the business was going to come and go, and it was going to ebb and flow, and I had to do the same. So by being able to understand that some days are going to be high and some days are going to be low, it balanced out. Being an entrepreneur sometimes is being like an athlete or an actor in some ways, and you have these great highs and these great lows. And selling is a great high in many ways.
All right.
Well, Peter is with Vistage Chair. How are you able? The value of senior people can't be calculated, I think. How are you able to tap into senior people for their time?
So I'm an EO member. I'm a member of YEO, which is now EO. I'm a member of Leadership Washington. I actually, when I started my business, I figured I didn't know anything about business. So I became a board member of a nonprofit and eventually became board chair of a nonprofit called Biteback, which gave back computer skills to underprivileged people. And I wanted to use that as my playground to see if I actually had any leadership skills. And we were able to survive and thrive, and that organization actually was up for the Washington Post Nonprofit of the Year Award.
How would you characterize your leadership style?
I would characterize my leadership style as intense and laid back simultaneously.
So how would I know that? What are you intense about and laid back about?
So our office environment is very flexible. People come and go. They get the work done. I don't micromanage people. I expect people to tell me what they do they're going to do. And when they don't, we part ways. And so I just expect people to perform. And so from that standpoint, they know where I stand, so we don't have to go into big debates. And we basically, I'm sort of laid back in that I'm flexible,
right?
But I want it done.
Okay. So this personal journey that you've accomplished, I know that's kind of been the seed for an organization that you're about to start. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So I was very fortunate. I befriended a 70-year-old psychologist recently who has had a passion around trying to get everything he's done professionally out into space. And he's been a organizational psychologist, so he's been with CEOs, he's done the work with CEOs, he's done the work in small businesses, and he's had a great deal of knowledge to parlay to people. Well, he and I have created through this journey a 12-step program to look at how you become fearless. And for us, fearless is to be awake, to be strong, and to be clear. And the awake part is self-awareness. The strong part is knowing your strengths, positive psychology, and the clear part is understanding your purpose.
So when would that company be launched?
We are trying to get it live by the first of the year. So good for you.
So how can somebody find out about you, Steve? Your website address.
My website address for the business is www.acquireddata.com with a single D. And for this other organization, it's learn2c.net.
Great. We've been speaking with Steve Seiden, who's the owner and president of Acquired Data Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleaders.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a minute, right after this business spot. This is your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Allera, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And for this segment, we have Sandeep Sangavi, who's the co-founder and CEO of a company called Data RPM Corporation. What is Data RPM Corporation, Sandeep?
We're the simplest, fastest, and most scalable analytics solution provider in the world.
Who says so?
Besides our co-founders and the crazy aspiration of disrupting analytics world, the media, and tech cocktail.
So you sound pretty confident about your product.
Very much so.
What makes it the best product in the space right now?
So what we've been able to do is, you know, this is my third startup, and we've been able to, I've had an interesting background of challenging the status quo and finding a way to disrupt things. At Data RPM, we've been able to innovate a technology that is built on search engine technology versus a traditional relational data model technology.
So, on your website, you say you have an addiction to developing disruptive technology. For the layman, what is disruptive technology?
I think every business, every software, every solution is built to improve certain things in a better way. When you look at something like iPhone, when you look at what Mark Benioff did at Salesforce, when he changed the way people do business, when you change the way the phone was operated, when you dramatically change things across, you know, mass media, mass people versus individuals, you're disrupting the way things get done.
Right. And when was this company founded?
Founded in 2010.
How big or small are you guys today?
14 of us.
Wow. And this is your third time?
This is the third time.
What were you doing the first two times?
Prior to this, I was with a company called SearchRidge, which provided BI as a service and mobile application development. And prior to that was a Razor site, founded in 01, bootstrapped it. I was blessed enough to bring Charlie Thomas on as CEO, raise some money.
What is it about startups that are so appealing to you?
And my wife like the same answer. I think from the background that we come from, my parents, my grandparents, there's an entrepreneurial side built into the family. My dad and his side of the family comes from a construction business in India. But generally like making a difference, changing the way things are for a betterment, for automation.
Take us back to where you're from.
Sure. Born and raised in India. I was about 9.5 years old when I came to U.S.
But the story is a little bit more interesting than that. Your grandfather has an association with a great historical figure.
Sure. So, stories is my grandfather served with Gandhi in the freedom fighting days. And, you know, I, as a kid eating breakfast or getting walked around with him, got stories of, you know, how many days he went fasting and how principle really, really mattered and what freedom really means when you're fighting for it versus having to give it to you on a silver platter.
How old were you when you're hearing these stories?
About eight.
About eight. So what goes on in the mind of an eight-year-old when you're hearing a story like that?
That, you know, you better appreciate what you have in front of you. And if you genuinely believe in something, passionately drive it, you know, have some principles of life and stand behind it.
Uh-huh. When did you come to the United States?
About when I was 9.5, 10.
And what was that experience like?
Didn't speak any English. That was a starting point. But, you know, it was great to see, you know, as I'm learning about our founding fathers of U.S., on the principles, you know, they built this country is about, you know, if you're willing to work hard, you know, have integrity, there will be success defined for you.
Yeah. Why did you come here?
So my sister got, phenomenal scores and equivalent of, what we go through the MCAT program here. And the school had asked to pay, you know, in better quote-unquote bribery to get in school. My father refused to do that. At the same time, we had a call for the visa of U.S., and he said, you know what, it's a much better education system out here. Packed up the bags, left his cushiony job, three servants, and came out to U.S. and for the education of the kids.
And he was willing to do something way beneath his capability.
Yeah, so the interesting experience for me growing up as a child is seeing a here's a guy that's, got a chauffeur, a servant, and, somebody literally clean his car every morning, comes to the United States and works for Time Warner, packaging, boxes of CDs just to make sure that his kids get a better education.
So what's a 9-year-old think? What's going on in the mind of a 9-year-old watching his father do that?
Humility.
Humility?
It's just, just humbleness, no matter what you, as things change in life and circumstances change, have enough passion and enough hard work capabilities to keep doing what you're doing.
Does your sister appreciate what your father did also?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, yes. We have a family reunion every year, and we talk. I mean, there's always stories going around, and this one is probably told by, by the parents and everybody else in the neighborhood quite some times.
And how has that helped you build your companies?
I think, grew into this family and the circumstances that we grew into, having the entrepreneurial background, seeing, I was doing books for my father when I was a young kid, did it for him when he was in U.S. as well, had that drive that if you set your mind to anything and if you have the passion and ability to work hard, you could truly accomplish anything you want to.
But it was the integrity. He was doing that in India and
yep.
was successful financially.
Yep.
But he balked.
Yeah, I think the ability to say that money can be earned in a lot of ways in life. You could, but you can't compromise your principles just for the money. And if you believe in principles so much, whether it's in your personal life or professional life, you got to stick to them. And if that means change, you do what you have to do.
Have you been shaped at all by your experiences growing up in India in the way that you lead?
probably more in U.S. and seeing the struggles in U.S. more than India. So I think what stuck with me more in India is about my grandparents, the stories I've heard from him.
Well, talk about your struggles in the United States then and how that shaped you as a leader.
Sure. So, you know, I've been sort of the youngest in everything I've done. So I graduated high school 1 year earlier. I graduated college 1 year earlier. I was stapling presentations for Arthur Andersen as a sophomore in college. And within the first 30 days, I was able to get a job as an analyst there. And I was questioned, saying, wait a minute, you're a 19-year-old kid as an analyst, or Arthur Andersen, you know, you don't belong here. But, you know, I always fought my ways of just because things work the way they were, have an ability to challenge it and disrupt it and make a difference.
So do you think the fact that you had some exposure to Gandhi and his principles through your grandfather and your father being willing to uproot a really good life for his children aided to the statement that's on your website, this addiction to developing disruptive technology?
I wouldn't be sitting here otherwise. It's truly made a difference, you know, from everything you and how we operate the business, ability to have everybody in the company have their own voice in the company and work together has made a big difference.
Have you ever failed at anything?
I have. I think, you know, my previous startup, I've made mistakes that made me learn from them. And again, you know, as humans, we make mistakes, and not to repeat them is a lesson we learn.
So take us through one,
sure,
if you don't mind.
Sure. I think, you know, as a young entrepreneur, you'll make calculated mistakes, and you'll surround yourself with people that are smarter than you to avoid some of those mistakes. But in when you become so fast-paced in the environment that you are, you'll make some decisions that you'll regret. And, you know, when you make them, I think ability to – I saw what my father did, and so when he left his cushiony job and came out of here and you know, and somebody asked him what they did, he's like, I packed CD boxes. And you know, when I made a mistake, I said, you know what, I'm going to live up to that mistake, you know, and have that ability to be humble and admit to it and then learn from it is something that I've learned a lot.
What do you like to work for?
You know, I like to make a change. I really like to make a difference. If I could find a way to automate people's lives, that's what drives me. It's my passion. It wakes me up every morning.
How about your leadership style? How would you characterize it?
Servant leadership. You know, I think what I've learned, you know, from my grandfather is that you can't lead by being a dictator. You have to lead by being a servant. So I think having people around you that believe in your cause, that believe in you, and the fact that you serve them versus them serving you makes a big difference.
Well, you mentioned you're your co-founder. Mm-hmm. Who is your co-founder, and does that person blend with you, or are they the same?
You know, actually, they have a bit of a different principle than where I come from, which always makes the company interesting. But Ruben and Gautam are the two other co-founders in the company. One comes from a very entrepreneurial technology background. The other one also has a technology background, yet has a philanthropic background as well. So when we talked about the idea of disrupting the analytics market, the BI market, we all came in sort of together on believing on the expression of frustrations that we have all gone through in our previous lives on implementing analytics solutions. We came together at the right time, at the right place to make this thing happen.
What's it like to have partners?
You know, my previous startups, I was the sole founder. So this makes it a lot more interesting, a lot more dynamics. I think you learn a lot. It's not lonely. You know, you're not the only one sleeping at night worrying about what's going to happen next morning. There's two other founders that are really part involved.
What would you say your proudest achievement is up till now? What are you most proud of?
I think the biggest thing I'm proud of is when my 9.5-year-old came up with a business idea about last year and actually created an internship program out of it at my company last year. Built a business model, built his first website. I said, you know, I've done something right in his life to be involved and hoping that, you know, the generations of entrepreneurship that has gone from our family will continue because I see that spark in him.
If I was interviewing your grandfather, would he be surprised at your success?
Probably so. You know, I was a rebel without a cause at an earlier age in my life, and he was a very good mentor for me.
Yeah, if he was here, what would you want to say to him?
Thank you. It's just the guiding principles. I think the walk on the beaches in Bombay, where you know, now you reflect back, and as you were 8.5-year-old, you're like, yeah, whatever. As you get older, you really come to respect you know, what I've learned from him.
Great. What's the website address, Sandeep?
www.datarpm.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Sandeep Sangavi, who's the co-founder and CEO of Data RPM. Corporation. I'd like to thank Ed Alera, from the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and joining us today is...
Stephen Seiden.
Steve, what's the name of your organization?
Learn to See.
Learn to See? What's Learn to See?
Learn to See is a peer group organization where we're trying to get people that are like-minded with like experiences to go deeper into their own self.
So give me an example of what that means, really.
That means to grow your self-awareness.
And why is that important?
Because as people and as CEOs and as leaders and in any walks of life, it's very important that we understand where our blind spots are and try to help move our own blind spots.
So for somebody that's curious what a blind spot is, somebody listening in and they're curious about theirs, how would you describe a blind spot?
A blind spot is when you end up somehow tripping over your own feet or doing something that you're not even know you're doing, because you don't have perspective from yourself or from others.
And because of that, it gets in the way of your results?
Absolutely.
Why is this so important to you?
Because as a CEO and as a leader and as a father and as a brother and in all the roles I've played, I've learned that I've had to be able to acknowledge my own strengths and weaknesses and figure out where I can grow and where I can be the best person I can be.
How can someone find out more about this organization?
You can go to the website. It's learn2c.net.
Say that one more time.
learn2c.net.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Steve Seiden. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this has been your Business Spotlight. And you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm talking with our next guest, Julia Stevens, who's the Executive Director of Crisis Link. What is Crisis Link, Julia?
Crisis Link is a crisis intervention and suicide prevention service operated or provided primarily through a 24/7 crisis hotline.
When was the organization founded?
The organization was founded in 1969 by volunteers in Arlington, and we've continued to operate there since then.
So just a community of like-minded people got together and started this organization?
Yes, indeed.
And here we are all these years later.
43 years, yep.
So how big or small is the organization today?
Right now we have 5 staff and well over 100 volunteers. Our crisis hotline is operated primarily by volunteers who go through an extensive training, so they know how to deal with the many crises or even people calling us who are suicidal.
Talk a little bit about how you go about bringing a volunteer into the system.
You know, we have volunteers who are wonderful, and they're from all walks of life. We have students who are thinking about or actually involved in some kind of helping professional program, such as social work or counseling program. We have executives who just want to do something very different in their free time, to retired professionals who want to continue helping people.
When did you join the organization?
I joined the organization at the first of the year.
Why?
Well, it brought me back to my community, to helping people in my neighborhood, using my mental health skills as well as my other program organizational operational skills.
When you say community, the Washington community or this community of helpers?
Well, I would say both. That's a good question, but I meant more to the local or the regional versus I had been working more on a national level.
Mm-hmm. Why were you the ideal pick for the job?
I was the perfect pick for the job because I have both a mental health background. I've worked as a music therapist, and then after about 10 years running different social service, human service programs at the community level, for many, many years. And then most recently, I oversaw different call centers across the country doing similar work to that of Crisis Link. So with my mental health and my call center background, it's a perfect combination.
How did you get into this business in the first place? the helping folks?
You know, my family had a strong history of helping both the neighbors, people in their community. My dad worked for Habitat for Humanity, but we also cared for family members in our home. My grandparents lived with us as I was growing up, so that helping others, I think, was just a part of my family's DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Music was also a strong part of my family, and when I found out there was actually a profession where you could use music to help people, I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Well, that's very interesting, because I wasn't familiar. How does the music therapy work, or what role does it play?
Music therapy works in many different ways, depending on who you're working with. In a psychiatric method, you can use music, listening to it or imagining different scenarios to the music to relax, to calm down, to settle the nerves. Or you can use it, for example, with developmentally delayed children to teach them how to move in time with the music if they have movement difficulties. So you can use it in lots of different ways. I've used it with seniors. To help stimulate memories and to keep the mind active.
Did you have brothers and sisters growing up?
Yes, I was the youngest of three.
What was that like?
Well, you know, they say the youngest got away with everything, and that, you know, they kind of paved the path for me. I thought that I was the one who, you know, by the time the third kid, you had to learn how to do it yourself. How many photographs are there of the third child? Not as many as of the first.
You sound bitter.
Yeah, well, it's a family issue. I don't know.
Okay. What were you like as a kid?
Probably pretty rambunctious. You know, I had a big streak of creativity, so we were making things and putting the couch cushions across a chair to make it an airplane. And
What were Mom and Dad doing growing up?
My dad was an aeronautical engineer. He actually worked at the beginning of the space industry through to the space shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
So it was
Mom?
Very exciting. Mom was stay-at-home, but also an artist, so a lot of art.
So how did that shape you, do you suppose?
I think I got the best of both of my parents. I think I have my dad's analytical engineering side and my mom's creativity side. So I can apply that creativity to solving the problems that I've analyzed and figured out.
But you're in a tough business that can be draining. How have you prepared for that?
Well, you know, one of the things that I learned early on, first of all, is you can only help people that want to be helped, A. And you can only do, you can't help someone else if you don't take care of yourself first. So you have to learn how to care for yourself. And we teach that actually to our volunteers on our crisis hotline, how to care for themselves so that they don't become stressed out and troubled by these crisis calls that they take.
How are you funded?
We're funded through some local government. Fairfax County and Arlington County both provide significant funding. We do different fundraising events. We also, I can't think.
Of. That's okay. Clear up a misconception that someone might have about a person contemplating suicide.
The first and foremost thing that I would say is it's okay to talk with them about their feelings. Too often people will avoid the topic, they'll avoid saying the word suicide, and it will not cause people to act on those feelings. In fact, it will be a release to them. It will help dissipate those feelings of suicide.
Mm-hmm. What, any other misconceptions maybe? Or not? That's okay.
Well, 1969 was the Beatles and LSD, and the world has changed. Has your business changed dramatically since 1969? Are there more recent changes that you're seeing?
Well, you know, we have found since 1969, I'm sure there have been recessions since then, but we've certainly had quite an increase in the calls, the number of calls we get based on the recent recession in this area and people needing assistance with basic needs.
Are you involved? Well, I've read the headlines recently that an alarmingly high suicide rate in the military is occurring. Do you help there?
Absolutely. In fact, I would just say generically, suicide, people in crisis, really knows no demographic, any one demographic. It certainly knows no income level. So people of all demographics have mental health issues and can have suicidal feelings. But yes, it is a growing issue and crisis, really, with our military. There was a recent Time magazine article about it where they said, and accurately so, one per day of our active duty military are dying by suicide. 18 per day of our veterans are dying by suicide. It is a national crisis.
Wow. How do you spend the bulk of your day now?
Well, I'm not on the hotlines, but I am helping, searching for funding, helping grow our programs, looking for ways to reach out, for example, to that military population. One of the things we know is that when people call us, we are very effective in helping them calm down, or we say de-escalate, and have a positive solution, who they're going to talk to, what they're going to do at the end of the phone call. But they have to call us. So much of my work is outreach, getting the information out, telling people they can call us, we're there to help.
How do you recruit volunteers, or how do you lead volunteers into this area?
Well, we, of course, have a website, and we take advantage of the many different organizations like Volunteer Fairfax that help, that people turn to when they're interested in volunteering. We also go to local universities and other professional groups where we might put the word out. We are very fortunate in that people know about us. They know about the good deeds we do. We have we are blessed by many, many excellent volunteers.
Five years from now, what would you like to look back on and have accomplished?
I would like to have accomplished two major things. One is I'd like to have put a stop to the military suicide problem. People need to call us, and we can help. And I'd like to put a stop to the suicide issue for our kids. Much of that it happens not in the schools, but you know, then it impacts the whole school and the whole neighborhood, and it's such a tragedy to lose a young person when, again, we know if they call us, we can make a difference.
Great. Julia, what's the website address for Crisis Link?
It's easy, www.crisislink.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Julia Stevens, who's the executive director for Crisis Link. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed O'Leary, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interviews today. We've had a great show, including Merdat Negabon, who is the founder and CTO of a company called Beam Smart Inc., Steve Snyden, the owner and president of Acquired Data Solutions, Sandeep Sangavi, the co-founder and CEO of Data RPM Corporation, and finally, Julia Stevens, the executive director of Crisis Link. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements.